This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we learn what you need to know about deep vein thrombosis. Plus, we examine the rising rates of hepatitis and how it's tied to liver cancer, the silent killer. But first, what is an internal defibrillator, and how can it prevent a chronic and serious cardiac problem? Some cardiac arrhythmias place patients at risk for sudden death, but a medical device called the implantable cardiac defibrillator can prevent this outcome. Here with more on this and how it works is Dr. Trayan Engel, Assistant Professor of Medicine, specializing in heart and vascular conditions, and the founding partner of the Heart Group of Syracuse, and Amy Tetrault, registered nurse and the Associate Director of the Heart and Vascular Center at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
So this implantable cardiac defibrillator can save lives. What is it, Dr. Engel, and how does it work?
Devices to help people with abnormal heart conditions, rhythm abnormality mainly, have been around for more than half a century now. Essentially, just briefly, you have two large groups of abnormal rhythms that can hurt people. One would be the slow rhythm group, and for that, a pacemaker would bring up the pace to the minimum required heart rate. And then you have people like the ones with heart failure, history of heart attacks, who are at a high risk of having fast abnormal rhythms, which essentially can bring upon such patients what's called sudden cardiac death. It's a very fast rhythm that essentially has the pumping chambers, we call it fibrillate, essentially twitching very fast and not pumping effectively.
Is that what they call atrial fibrillation, or is it both kinds?
This is ventricular fibrillation.
This is ventricular fibrillation.
The atria are the upper chambers of the heart, but the truly life-threatening conditions are the ones affecting the lower chambers, the ventricles. So that's where if one had a heart attack and there's a scarring left after, you can have a short circuit, let's say, around a scar like that. And the risk, by now we have very good science to show that the risk of having sudden cardiac death due to a fast rhythm like this, like ventricular fibrillation, can be as high as 1 in 6.
Wow.
15% or 16% per year from time of diagnosis of such.
So these kinds of electrical malfunctions, for want of a better term, in the heart, why do they occur? Is it all age-related generally, or is it just happenstance?
It's essentially in most people. Again, it follows coronary artery disease, essentially plumbing issues. Those blockages can lead to overt heart attacks or silent heart attacks that can leave enough scarring in the heart muscle to disable the cardiac function, so your pump function decreases, but also the structure itself of the heart muscle wall is no longer normal. You have an island or islands of scar in the middle of normal or almost normal heart muscle, and that interface between that scar-like tissue and the normal tissue creates electrical gradients that can bring about the ventricular fibrillation.
So almost like a short circuit.
Exactly. And essentially, as opposed to the pacemakers, which actively bring the heartbeat up, the defibrillators are acting by stopping fast rhythms. And traditionally, the main intervention has been to deliver a shock that essentially resets all the electrical activity of the heart cells.
So it's like a reset on a computer,
exactly,
or something.
It's pretty much like in the movies, you know, pedals on,
they put
everybody
the paddles
clear.
On.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, these devices have been for about 40 years now implantable. So the
Let me get this straight. For 40 years, we've already been able to implant these.
Yes.
The pacemaker for the slow rhythm.
The pacemaker actually for even longer than that.
Even longer. First, but that's for the slow rhythm.
Yeah.
And these defibrillators for the fast rhythm.
Correct.
And there have been, I had no idea they've been implantable that long.
They have been implantable for that long. There is excellent science to show that they are essentially mainstay of a therapy to prevent ventricular fibrillation. Because, you know, if you have ventricular fibrillation, your chance of making it to the hospital and back home is less than 20%.
Wow.
So medications don't work very well. by no means as good as the defibrillator. So they have been at the forefront of therapy for quite a while now. The way the implantable cardiac defibrillators have come about being used essentially followed on the heels of pacemakers. You know, to have a heartbeat controlled with the currently available technology, you need to have some wire get to the heart. So this is how transvenous systems have developed around the need to pace. That's the technology that the defibrillators picked up on, and they essentially modified the pacing lead such that you can use by coiling, threading some special circuitry on top of the wire that goes to the heart, boosting up the battery that's lodged in the can that's surgically implanted at the chest wall, not inside the chest wall, but underneath the skin.
Yeah.
Essentially, you use a similar technology to deliver a shock should one's heart go too fast in an abnormal rhythm.
So this system that you're talking about has the pacemaker as a part of it and the ability to shock the heart as well.
Traditionally, the implantable systems have had a built-in, even if only backup, pacing capabilities. Now, the newer technology that we have started using at Upstate, which we're here to talk about, the subcutaneous, all subcutaneous implantable cardiac defibrillator.
I'm going to stop you there.
Yes.
Subcutaneous implantable defibrillator. Let's help us understand when you say subcutaneous, how is that different than what you were doing before?
So before, essentially, we would get access to a vein under surgical conditions.
You would surgically go in and find the
vein.
Yes,
and thread the wire, at least one wire to the heart under x-ray and screw literally the tip of the wire in the heart muscle at one end and in the other in the can that contains the computer chip and the electronics, the battery to control.
And where would that sit? Where would
the generator would sit. At most of the time the left chest wall under the clavicle, right? Essentially the size, traditionally the size of a matchbox.
Just under the skin in that case as
just
well?
Just under the skin for the traditional defibrillator. The only thing that would be under the skin would be the generator. The leads, the wires are traveling
into
intravascular
the
to the heart. And obviously they are made of plastic and metal. There's, like with everything that's man-made, there's some small risk of something going wrong, a risk of mechanical or electrical problems related. And obviously if one gets that intravascular system infected, the system will have to come out because the metal and the plastic would not be able to defend themselves against.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with cardiologist Dr. Treyan Angel and registered nurse Amy Tetrol. We're talking about this new implantable defibrillator. So how is the technology different now, and what is the benefit that we're receiving from it?
So for about 10 years now, people have tried to use the all subcutaneous, all underneath the skin, generator and conductor and wire.
So that system. Nothing has to go down
so
into the heart.
So nothing has to go into inside the heart. The risk of the procedure is much smaller because the whole thing is lodged under the heart. It's all made more robust than what you need to have to wriggle through a vasculature to get to the heart. So essentially at this point, it's already been used in Europe for quite a few good years. It's been long approved by now by the FDA for use in this country. And we have the capability of using this a new device, new technology, where essentially you have a, let's say, deck of cards-sized generator that's lodged at the lateral side of the left chest wall, and lower in the armpit, let's say. And from there, you thread underneath the skin, all underneath the skin, the conductor that you bring about to the midline, to the breastbone, and then up for a technique that's called tunneling, where essentially you just allow passage through the fat underneath the skin of a metal wire, and you have a couple of sutures, one at the top of the breastbone where the end of the conductor lies, and then as it makes a turn towards the side of the breast, towards the generator, there's another suture there, and then that's pretty much it. That's the implant. Now, with all these devices, because they are meant to address a life-threatening condition, you want to test them. So you literally push the patient with us as a backup plenty backup in the lab, into ventricular fibrillation to assess the appropriateness of the therapy.
So you check out and you make sure that this device is working after you put it in.
We test fire it after we put it in. And that's the whole procedure.
Yeah, amazing. Amy, why is this so different than what's happened before, and why is it important?
I think it's important for the listeners to know that there are options for each of them, and important for them to know that within the Upstate community, within the Syracuse community, that those options exist and that there's a dedication from our physicians not only to seek out this new technology, but to apply themselves to the training and to learn what needs to be done for these patients, and also for the institutions have made that dedication, that commitment to provide these services for our patients so that there are options, as Dr. Engel has said, either traditional types of ICDs or for patients that might not be appropriate for, or they may have a special need, that the subcutaneous ICD may be a better option for them.
So getting back to that whole notion of this versus the, the earlier ones, this has less potential complications. Is it also more effective?
No, it's not known to be, at least to date, more effective. It's at least as effective as the implantable defibrillator. Obviously, it doesn't have the pacing capabilities of the implantable defibrillator, so that we don't consider people who would have a need now or prospectively for pacing for subcutaneous defibrillators. But there's a.
So when you say that, you mean you wouldn't necessarily use that for people who have the slow rate?
Some people have both the slow rate
and
problem
the
and the
rate.
Fast rate problem. And for those, at this point, the only good
solution.
Alternative would be the transvenous old
the
style
one that goes all the way into the heart itself.
Right.
But the point is, this is new technology. And have you done many of these, and what are the results?
We actually just started doing them. We have done a handful of them to date. But you know, like with very new technology, we have to get up to speed with training personnel and stuff like that. But I think Van also talking to what may consist hopefully just as an early impediment to this taking off is also the fact that though it's FDA approved and the CMS has no problem
the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services
correct seeing this as standard of care therapy, just like the old style defibrillator has been.
So they have approved it.
Right, it's all well approved.
And
it's
insurance
not,
will cover.
It's long not considered experimental therapy anymore. However, commercial insurances still consider it experimental.
Oh, so if you have a private insurance,
right.
You might have some issues with coverage.
So that has actually to date been the main restricting factor in providing this therapy. Now, I expect that as local insurances learn more and more about this and feel more comfortable looking around them and seeing what other people are doing, well, this will also grow accepted in that kind of...
Now, how you were talking about the procedure in some senses into how it's implanted very graphically in terms of where it's located. Is this done outpatient, and is it done under local anesthesia? How is this actually done?
It's done on what we call observational patient, so there is a overnight stay following this just to make sure that we can provide the patient with enough pain control because of the three incisions. But other than that, it's like I said, a lower risk procedure than the other one.
Very low
patient
risk.
Is expected to go home the morning after.
And then you do this test to make sure that it's functioning
properly.
That's
during implant at the time of the procedure, yes.
And does the battery last? We have a little bit of time left. Is the battery meant to last a long time?
The battery is meant to last 4, 5, 6 years.
And then if you need that replacement, the battery just gets replaced?
Very good question. We cannot take the battery out of the can. It's all welded titanium. But you replace the can as a whole, and you leave the wire in place. Advantage being that way, not only do you get a new battery, you also get the newest generator technology.
Sounds very exciting. Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming in. My guests have been Dr. Trayan Engel, Assistant Professor of Medicine, specializing in heart and vascular conditions, and Amy Tetrault, registered nurse and the Associate Director of the Heart and Vascular Center at Upstate Medical University. Coming up next, what you need to know about deep vein thrombosis. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Approximately 2 million people in the United States each year suffer from deep vein thrombosis, which in some cases can lead to severe complications and even death. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Palma Shaw. She's Associate Professor of Surgery in the Division of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Shaw. Thanks for coming in. So let's talk about this concept, deep vein thrombosis. What is that? What does it mean when we say that?
Deep vein thrombosis is when blood clots form within veins in the other parts of the body, such as the legs or the arms or even in the pelvis.
So when we say deep vein versus what? I mean, it suggests that maybe there's a superficial vein thrombosis as well?
Yes, so there are superficial veins, for example, veins you can see under your skin that at times can develop clot and they can become inflamed. And that's actually the term thrombophlebitis really means clot and inflammation of the vein. And that, again, can be either superficial in location or deep within the body. And those veins that are deep are actually the ones that are closer to the bones and deep within the muscles.
I see. So it's when a clot occurs in the body at those points, that's what's considered deep vein thrombosis. Well, who's at risk? Why does this occur?
There are certain patients who we find are at increased risk of DVT. There are patients who are, for example, maybe obese. There are some patients who, in fact, have a genetic predisposition to clot, and their veins, the veins will develop clot within them more easily than another person. Patients who are elderly, possibly in part because they're less active. And when patients are less active and the blood pools within the deep veins, there's a higher risk of clot formation rather than when the blood is moving around more efficiently. Also, sometimes when we've done surgery on patients, again, they're not as active, or, for example, we may operate on the leg or on the hip or on the arm, and just working within that area causes distortion of the anatomy, causes inflammation, and ultimately can cause clots forming within the veins.
How about things I've heard it said, for example, if you're on an airplane on a long flight or something like, or you're in a car ride in a long flight, the chances of something like DVT occurring. Is that the case as well, inactivity for long periods of time?
Yes, that certainly becomes a risk factor for patients. And also, when you fly, you can read in the airplane magazine their recommendations to avoid those things. So it's become such a problem that even the airlines are bringing the awareness to their customers. And it's really recommended that when you go on prolonged car rides or when you take longer flights, if you can't get up and walk around, then you should at least try to move your legs around, pump your calf muscles, try to push down, for example, like you're stepping on the pedal of the gas or releasing that while you're sitting for that prolonged time.
So I know. I also saw, actually, that struck me as interesting, is that even something like pregnancy or taking birth control pills can make you more at risk for DVT.
So certain hormonal imbalances, different parts of our body will react differently. And in particular, in pregnancy, early on, the pregnant woman will develop dilation of the veins, and they may get swelling. And
so we end up with varicosities, like myself,
for
example.
You could end up with varicosities, but also you end up with pooling of the blood, and that's why they get swelling. But also then the blood doesn't circulate as well, and they become at increased risk.
So how serious is this? We're talking about clots in the deep veins. I mean, what does that do to you? Where's the danger?
Well, aside from the fact that you don't feel well, you don't feel normal. You may feel like your leg or arm is quite swollen. The patient may complain about redness. Sometimes then if that clot goes from the calf and moves up the leg, up, and the clot becomes larger, or even a small clot, can actually break off and travel to the lungs. That can affect your breathing, make the person short of breath, also cause a rapid heart rate, and the patient may feel palpitations, like their heart is fluttering. Sometimes the patient may have a light fever.
So those are all symptoms of DVT, but you've mentioned this moving clot, which is also called an embolism, and you say it goes to the lungs. So one of the consequences is this pulmonary embolism, and how serious is that?
So a pulmonary embolism can in fact cause death.
So this is quite serious.
It's very serious. And we try to make people aware of the symptoms that may be related to a pulmonary embolism. The only problem is that these are symptoms that may be related to other medical problems as well, so it becomes hard to be very clear.
So tell me, let's go back over the symptoms of DVT. You mentioned swelling in the leg, a rapid heartbeat, potentially a slight fever, some tenderness, some ache. So if you have, but you also said that those symptoms can be resembling of many other things. So how is this diagnosed? What do you recommend people doing?
The first thing the person should do is call their medical doctor, especially if it's during the day, during the weekday. They should reach out to their primary care doctor and speak to the office and see if they can determine whether or not they should come in to have further evaluation. The primary care doctor may just send the patient in directly for an ultrasound of the affected area.
So an ultrasound is one of the methods of diagnosis.
Yes, and that's one of our first line studies that we do perform. Sometimes a blood study is performed. It's called a D-dimer. And that may be elevated in the presence of an abnormal clot formation. But from an anatomic perspective, the ultrasound really gives us an image of how far up the leg or how far up the arm the clot is extended, and whether it's a new clot or whether the person may have had an old clot they weren't even aware of, and now this is actually a clot forming on top of an old clot.
Wow, and that can happen.
And that can happen, yes.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with vascular surgeon Dr. Palma Shaw, and we're talking about deep vein thrombosis and a serious complication of it called a pulmonary embolus. So what do you do to treat DVT?
Once we make the diagnosis, we will treat the patient with an anticoagulant. It's otherwise called a blood thinner.
And that prevents the clot from either growing or perhaps breaking off. Is that the idea?
The anticoagulants or blood thinners will prevent, hopefully, the clot from extending or increasing in size within the body. That's to be differentiated from other medications that are in general public terms called clot buster medications, which actually actively break up the clot within the body.
So those are also given at times?
They may be given. And the important thing is that the patient has to be fully assessed, because there are risks of giving blood thinners and more risks of giving clot buster medication. And that, again, has to be carefully assessed almost at the same time as you're making the diagnosis, because you do need to quickly treat.
So obviously, it's very, very important to know if you have DVT because of all these dangers associated with it. What exactly, when we talk about the pulmonary embolism, which seems to be the most serious potential consequence of the DVT, what exactly is it and what causes it to occur? I mean, you can have DVT without having an embolism break off, right?
Yes, of course. And when the clot may break off and go to the lung, it causes not only a blockage of that part of the artery in the lung that would normally do the exchange of oxygen that you need to breathe and function normally, but in addition, it also causes something, what's called a vasoconstriction. So if there's one main vessel that's blocked, several other around that area may also constrict down, so the effect is magnified.
So you really have trouble breathing. So what are some of the symptoms of a PE or a pulmonary embolism? I mean, how would you know, for example, that you might be experiencing this?
Some people may not be aware at all that they've had a pulmonary embolism, but one of the most common symptoms is a sudden shortness of breath. People feel that they just went up the steps and they just can't quite catch their breath. It hasn't gone away. They may have chest pain.
So it could mimic a heart attack, for that matter.
Or a feeling of anxiety, dizziness, lightheadedness, likely related to the decreased amount of oxygen that they're receiving. Again, the heart may race, and even the patient may cough up blood.
So what are the factors that would allow somebody who has this DVT? I mean, are there other kind of what we call comorbidities or other things that are happening in the body that would lead you potentially to both the DVT and the PE? You mentioned some of them for DVT, but are there others that would cause you to get the pulmonary embolism on top of it?
The location of the clot and the size of the clot are probably the most important factors. in putting a patient at risk of getting a clot that moves up to the lung.
So those are so along the lines of diagnosis, that early diagnosis, do they ever use imaging like MRI as well to determine the clot?
Sometimes we use MRI for complicated situations, usually when we think that the clot is extended beyond the arms or legs. Additionally, we may use a CAT scan. We can do, for example, to diagnose pulmonary embolism, a very commonly used study is a CT scan, CT pulmonary angiography study, which is extremely helpful in determining not only the fact that there's a pulmonary embolism, but the location and size. And using that information, we can predict the effect, because when that much strain is put on the lungs, it transmits back the pressure onto the heart. And then there's a tremendous amount of strain on the heart.
And can that lead to further heart problems like heart arrhythmias or
heart
even
failure.
Heart failure?
Yes, cardiac arrest.
So when you find a patient with DVT and later on going on to a PE or a pulmonary embolism, what do you try to do? What's the major treatment at that point?
As soon as possible, we anticoagulate the patient. In fact, even if we are unable to get a rapid ultrasound, maybe it's the middle of the night and the tech isn't readily available, but we have a good clinical suspicion. We may have a positive D-dimer level in the blood that we drew in.
Indicating that there may be clotting activity.
There may be other clotting activity going on that's unusual. We may opt to treat the patient with anticoagulation if there's no reason not to.
So that's a crucial form of treatment. I also read something about some kind of a screen or something, like a venous cave of... You have to help me with it.
Vena cava filter.
Yeah.
So we do place vena cava filters most commonly in the location of the inferior vena cava, which is the major vein in your abdomen that carries almost all the blood from the lower part of the body. And then we place that almost like a little umbrella to filter any potential blood clots. And most of the time, those are 97 to 98% effective in doing so. But that does not actually treat the pulmonary embolism, and it does not treat the DVT, and it does not reduce the chance of increased clot development.
It just prevents the PE from going up there.
Going up.
If something breaks off, it prevents it from actually going up into the lungs.
That's
so these
right.
are all different methods.
It doesn't take the place of anticoagulation, right?
So ultimately, in the very little time we have left, what's the takeaway? What do you say to people?
Who might think,
because some of this can be silent. So what do you say in terms of knowing if you have DVT and then what to do about it?
I think all patients need to be aware of activities that may put them at increased risk of getting clots. For example, prolonged car rides, long flights. Then additionally, patients who have risk factors that we've already discussed, who may be at higher risk, they know they're sedentary, they know they don't move around a lot, they know they have inflammatory disorders that tend to be linked to clots. They need to be more sensitive to changes in their body that might be symptoms that are related to DVT. And then they have to promptly act, call their doctor. And if they cannot get a hold of their doctor and they don't feel well, they should go to the emergency room and be evaluated promptly and try to understand whether or not this is the issue.
And then there are these treatments in place that can really help.
Yes.
And prevent potentially death.
Yes.
I want to thank you so much. This is crucial information. My guest has been Dr. Palma Shaw. She's Associate Professor of Surgery in the Division of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is registered dietitian Maureen Franklin with Healthy Eats. Summertime food safety. The grill has been fired up and you've been cooking on it for weeks, but have you brushed up on your food safety tips? If you haven't already, take the time to make sure your grill is clean, scrub it with hot soapy water, and rinse it thoroughly. Do the same for the outdoor utensils. Check the burners on your gas grill to ensure safe ignition and an even flame. A meat thermometer is an essential grilling tool. It takes the guesswork out of cooking and helps to prevent foodborne illnesses by assuring that your food is cooked to the proper temperature. Make sure to buy a thermometer that is designed to use with meats, has an easy-to-read dial, and a shatterproof lens. Use one set of plates and utensils to handle raw food and another set for cooked food. As cross-contamination tops the list of food safety concerns during the outdoor grilling season. Remember to wash your hands for at least 20 seconds before, during, and after handling food. Keep a bottle of hand sanitizer handy if soap and water aren't accessible. Don't forget to wash the fruits and vegetables you'll be using. Scrub firm produce such as melons and cucumbers with a clean produce brush. Use two separate cutting boards, one for raw meat and another for vegetables and fruits. Basting a meat on the grill, always use a separate or clean brush. Keep track of how long your food has been out. Don't let food stay unrefrigerated for more than 2 hours, 1 hour in 90-degree weather. Remember these sayings: keep hot food hot, cold food cold, and my favorite, when in doubt, throw it out. These quick and easy tips can help you to keep yourself, your family, and your guests safe and healthy to enjoy the delicious foods of summer. So remember these four easy steps. Number one, wash. Wash your hands and utensils with hot, soapy water as often as needed. Number two, separate. Avoid cross-contamination. Number three, cook. Cook your foods thoroughly. And number four, refrigerate. Refrigerate your foods promptly and at the proper temperatures. For more information on food safety, check out homefoodsafety.org. This has been Maureen Franklin, registered dietitian, with your serving of Healthy Eats.
Next up, how is hepatitis linked to liver cancer, and what should you do about it? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of July 28th. Retreat from the heat. Between 1979 and 2003, more Americans died from excessive heat exposure than from hurricanes, lightning, tornadoes, floods, and earthquakes combined. Extreme heat is a real concern that can cause serious health problems like exhaustion, heat stroke, cramps, sunburn, and rashes. This week, take precautions to avoid heat-related illnesses. Make sure to drink more fluids, avoid alcoholic and sugary beverages, wear lightweight and light-colored, loosely fitting clothing, limit outdoor activity to the morning or evening, and stay in an air-conditioned place during the afternoon heat. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Worldwide, chronic infection with hepatitis causes 80% of all primary liver cancers, and more than 500,000 people die each year from this lethal disease. Currently, primary liver cancer has only a 5-year survival rate of 10%. And here with more on this deadly disease is Dr. A.J. Jain. He's Associate Professor of Surgery and Associate Chief of Hepatobiliary and Pancreatic Surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Jain. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So hepatitis is on the rise worldwide. Why is that?
There are multifactorial reasons for that. In some countries, and especially in parts of Asia, parts of the Middle East, hepatitis B especially is endemic, and the incidence of hepatitis C is also quite high. So just through population growth and through sanitation practices and surgery and blood transfusion and through IV drug abuse, these things can be spread. In the United States, certainly hepatitis C transmission is strongly associated in the current age with IV drug abuse, and in the past has been associated with blood transfusions before screening was initiated in a widespread fashion, as well as a remote history of IV drug abuse back in the 1960s. So there's many people who may be carriers of this virus and who don't know that they have it.
So we're basically talking about hepatitis, which is these two viruses that you've already, and I think there's a third one, isn't there, hepatitis A as well?
Hepatitis A, but that's a completely different route of transmission, and that doesn't cause chronic infection. That's foodborne, and that's not terribly different than getting an acute flu or something of that sort. It's not going to set up a permanent infection in your liver that will set you up for a risk of cancer down the road.
So getting back to that idea, so both hepatitis B and hepatitis C have a connection to liver cancer, primary liver cancer, which
That's
is
right.
what I said. Help us understand, what is that connection? What is the mechanism for these viruses to cause this cancer?
So both hepatitis B and hepatitis C can cause chronic, long-term infection of the liver that lasts the course of a lifetime. And over time, this can cause inflammation and changes in the liver. It can cause fibrosis of the liver, scarring, and this can lead to cirrhosis, and this can actually cause basically two long-term health problems. It can cause problems associated with cirrhosis and liver failure, and the changes in the liver can also then set you up to form a cancer as well, typically hepatocellular or liver cancer is the one we worry about.
So an actual cancer will develop in that
Correct.
Affected liver.
Yes.
Help define cirrhosis exactly, because when we make that allusion, I'm not sure our listening audience always understands what exactly is that.
So cirrhosis is a chronic disease of the liver. Basically what happens is chronic inflammation of the liver can then cause scarring of the liver. You get fibrosis, and progresses over time, and the normal liver tissue gets disrupted by the scarring and the fibrosis, and eventually the liver function gets compromised over time.
So it malfunctions. It's no longer
right.
doing,
it can no
doing
longer,
its job.
It can't do what it's supposed to do, and then it also sets you up again to form a cancer.
So these two types of viruses, the HB and the HC, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, they cause these long-term infections. Are they both likely to cause symptoms, or is one, I've heard somewhere that one is what we call a more silent
right.
disease.
So, you know, infection with hepatitis in the acute phase can cause symptoms such as, you know, right upper quadrant pain. It can cause, you know, fevers, not feeling well. It can cause jaundice. But oftentimes, especially hepatitis C infection, can be completely asymptomatic, and people can get infected and not know they have it. And then in the long-term phase, it's often asymptomatic. You can harbor this infection for decades and have absolutely no symptoms. And sometimes the first symptoms don't present until that late-stage liver disease has set in.
But as you said, there are people who are more at risk for both of these kinds of infections. Tell us about that. Who are these people? Who would the people be that might have this and unknowingly have it?
So the main route of transmission of hepatitis B and hepatitis C is through blood, through bloodborne transmission. So one of the risk factors is IV drug abuse, sharing needles. Blood transfusions can certainly carry a risk. In the United States, we've screened the blood supply aggressively for hepatitis B and hepatitis C since the early 1990s. But people who received blood transfusions before then, especially the baby boomer generation and such, may have had an exposure to these viruses and not know it. People who have also been on dialysis prior to that time period could have also had a blood exposure as well. So they may be at risk for it as well. Folks from the developing countries who may have had surgery or been exposed to blood could certainly be at risk. It can be, some of these viruses can be transmitted sexually as well, but it's a low risk relative to actual bloodborne exposure. And also healthcare workers are at risk, especially if people have exposure to sharps or splash injuries where blood can get in the eye. So if a healthcare worker has had an occupational exposure, they may be at risk and need to be screened.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. I'm here with Dr. A.J. Jain. He's Associate Professor of Surgery and Associate Chief of Hepatobiliary and Pancreatic Surgery at Upstate Medical University. We're talking about the increase of liver cancer in patients with chronic hepatitis. I want to get to two quick things. you can do something for both of those kinds of hepatitis. Am I correct?
There are treatments available for hepatitis. In particular, there are some now new classes of antiviral drugs. First, if you've been diagnosed with a hepatitis C infection, you can get interferon. Interferon is a treatment that's available that can actually help clear the viral load. And
which means you can be cured of it?
Not cured of it per se, but it's almost analogous to the way that you can survive with HIV for a long time with the new.
Right.
You can basically knock the viral level down, keep it quiescent. And now there's a new class of antiviral drugs that have just recently become available for hepatitis C, which show great promise.
And isn't there also a vaccine for one of those?
For hepatitis B. And certainly, in the United States, we recommend vaccination for hepatitis B. And if you're a healthcare worker, you certainly should be, in my opinion, vaccinated, given the fact that you have a significant occupational risk for it. And it's a highly effective vaccine.
And are they also doing it for children? Are they?
They are. They are. My children are vaccinated against hepatitis
B. So routinely, I think in this country these days, they're doing hepatitis
B. It's a yes, ma'am. It's a recommendation.
So let's get to primary liver cancer, because that's the killer. I mean, and that also can be silent.
That can be silent, because usually the cancer doesn't present until later stages. So what happens is you have this chronic infection in the liver, the changes occur to the liver, and then the cancer can form in that setting. And oftentimes it doesn't cause symptoms until late stages.
When we say primary versus secondary liver cancer, what's the distinction?
So a primary, so liver cancer, when people think of liver cancer, a layperson would say a cancer in the liver, but a cancer can start in the liver, and that's what we as physicians would call a primary liver cancer, one that arises from liver tissue, as opposed to a cancer that may have gone to the liver from somewhere else, such as the colon. Colon cancer can go to the liver, for example.
So what other things besides the hepatitis itself can also lead to this kind of primary liver cancer? What other risk factors are there?
So if you're actually talking about hepatocellular cancer, which is the one that we most commonly talk about, that is cancer that arises from the liver tissues as opposed to the bile ducts or some other areas of the liver, that's really associated with, again, long-term inflammation, fibrosis of the liver. So one of the risk factors for that is alcohol use can also cause cirrhosis. As I said, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, there are certain liver diseases that can cause, genetic diseases that can cause also a risk factor for
liver. So family history of some kind.
Usually it's not so much a family history of hepatocellular cancer, but there are other chronic liver conditions that are rare, but that can cause inflammation in the liver that can predispose you.
How about obesity and diabetes? Do those also predispose you?
In general, I'm not aware of any link between obesity and diabetes. Actually, let me clarify that statement. Obesity now is actually being associated with something called non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, NASH is the acronym for it. And that can cause, again, chronic inflammation of the liver. And we do expect over time that we may see a rise in the incidence of hepatocellular cancer that is not really associated with classical risk factors such as alcohol use or hepatitis infection. And what happens is if people have steatohepatitis, which is a fancy word for inflammation of the liver due to fat, a fatty liver, then that can also cause changes in the liver that lead to cirrhosis and ultimately hepatocellular cancer.
And is there any gender distinction here? I mean, is it more apt? Would you be more apt to get liver cancer as a male or a female?
I'm not aware offhand of a gender difference. That doesn't mean that there is one, but there are some data to suggest that women actually may be more susceptible to the changes associated with fat in the liver.
As I said before, liver cancer is a silent killer, because I guess you don't get pain until much later. So how would you recommend both prevention and then later treatment for this problem? Because obviously, it's as I said, there's not a very long-term cure rate for it.
So I think starting off with prevention, I think that I'm a strong believer in the vaccines. I think for the hepatitis B, there is a vaccine that's available, and I think that it's very wise to have this vaccine. It's a preventable, it's a highly effective, and it's a effective vaccine. In terms of hepatitis C, there is not a vaccine. I mean, I'm looking forward to the day when they actually do make a vaccine for it. Then there's also general risk factor avoidance, obviously, avoiding IV drug use. If people are using IV drugs, they should absolutely not share needles, use needle exchange program, dispose of the needles appropriately. Alcohol avoidance, again, maintaining a healthy body mass index so that you're not falling to the range of obesity where you might be at risk for steatohepatitis. That actually is not going to prevent hepatitis, I'm sorry. That would have...
prevent the liver cancer.
Prevent itself. Liver disease and liver cancer and the alcohol as well.
But. Didn't the CDC recently say that they wanted most people born between 1945 and 65, the so-called baby boomers, to be tested at least once for the hepatitis C virus?
That's a very recent recommendation, and that's, again, because there's a high possibility, you know, there's a high risk for the baby boomer generation to have been exposed and potentially not know about it. You may not be aware that you got blood when you were a child or that you might have had an exposure, or people may be experimented with drugs once.
In the very little bit of time we have left, who should be screened for liver cancer itself?
People who have a known diagnosis of hepatitis B or C, or who have liver disease associated with alcohol use or fatty disease. And again, by visiting your primary care doctor and by undergoing certain screening tests, such as for the virus or routine blood work, they may be able to, if they discover that you have liver disease, then you should probably be screened for hepatocellular cancer, which can be done through ultrasound or other imaging studies.
So imaging is the
left. And also there's some blood work that they can do as well.
Wonderful. Well, the takeaway obviously is screening, especially if you have any risk factors at all for either of these viruses. Thank you so much.
Thank you very
much. Appreciate your time very much. My guest has been Dr. A.J. Jain. He's Associate Professor of Surgery and the Associate Chief of Hepatobiliary and Pancreatic Surgery at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. We know it often takes courage for the person with a serious illness to keep going, to do whatever is necessary to achieve good health again. The Healing Muse often includes poignant testimonies from caregivers, those who wait and help in this healing process. They, too, must possess courage and great determination. They live sometimes on two levels. They hear and feel what is being said aloud, but inwardly they fear many things. Poet Lynn Lifshin offers us two poems in which the speaker is caring for her beloved and trying not to focus on their mutual fears. The first poem is called In the Video of Your Heart. In the video of your heart, the orange and blues swirl, waves under an ocean, a gush of water, a flash of blood. It's a tape to sleep by if I didn't know it was the clicks and murmurs that have to be fixed. Like a sluice pump or the water going over Otter Falls, loud enough to sweep trees up in its rushing water, the roots tangling in the air like the arms of someone drowning or the pale wrists of a woman beckoning or waving goodbye. Her second poem is called When You Talk About Making Dinner for Friends. When you talk about making dinner for friends when you retire in 5 years, I say nothing. I'm thinking only to the first snow, to a white blanketing us together. When my mother talked of her next spring, I thought only of a summer, a few weeks of lilacs, roses. We'll visit Virginia, D.C., once a year, you say, and I'm trying to remember mantras of hearts and valve repairs. You see yourself in a kitchen with copper pots and ladles, definitely not a white tile floor that shows every stain, while I try not to stare at the floor, as if I dug in, I'd uncover cracked skulls, bones, your words still cling to, heart tissue, all I'm afraid to lose. ¶¶
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we explore how seniors can stay safe in these summer months. And are you at risk for oral cancer? We'll find out next week. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.